The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
24 hours a day, 7 days a week. The news never stops. Life goes on around town and around the world. You need a talk show that keeps track of it. A program with bold opinions that's always open to your views. That is this show. Welcome to the Mark Davis Show on 660 AM. The Answer.
Hour number two on this Tuesday, the 16th day of April, 2024. Great to have you here. And great to have Senator John Cornyn here. No shortage. Every time he could come on every 3 days, and there's no shortage of stuff to talk about. Senator, welcome back, sir. How you doing?
Thanks, Mark. Good to be with you.
So let's do Israel, and let's do the ongoing Hamas war, and let's go the Iranian drone strikes, and this weird passive aggressive stance by the Biden White House that refers to its ironclad support for Israel's security, yet behind closed doors and sometimes publicly seeks to restrain them from retaliating and restrain them from actually beating Hamas. What are we to make of these people?
Well, frankly, I think, our allies don't trust us anymore and our adversaries don't fear us because they realize that even though President Biden may say the right words when it comes to an ironclad support for Israel, he's trying to micromanage the way they defend their nation from terrorist proxies like Hamas and now from Iranian attack and saying, okay, you succeeded in shooting down virtually all the drones and the ballistic missiles, but don't do anything to retaliate. But, there needs to be some sort of deterrence. And unless Iran feels the consequences of their aggression through acts of deterrence, then they're going to keep coming. So I disagree with the Biden administration's policy.
There's been words mean things, and the words just keep coming back in a haunting fashion. He's been asked multiple times, what do you say to Hamas? What do you say to Hezbollah? What do you say to Iran? And don't. We can see how well that worked. The words of the last couple of days have involved, take the win. It's 99% successful repulsion of these drones. So take the win and be done. I've seen you signal some disagreement with that.
Yeah, well, Israel could be done, but Iran will never be done. I mean, this is not a one-off. This has been going on since the Iranian Revolution in 1979. Iran's been responsible for killing Americans in Iraq through the use of these explosively formed penetrators, and has been engaged in what some have called a twilight war with the West since that time. And of course, they're committed to erasing Israel from the map. And you can't bargain with people like that. You have to defeat them. You have to deter them.
Over in the House, Mike Johnson signals that a vote for aid to support Israel will be separate from a vote for aid and support to Ukraine. Does that seem right to you?
Well, the irony, Mark, is that the House passed an Israel aid bill in November of last year, just about a month after the attack on October the 7th. And Senator Schumer chose to sit on that and then to package it with the larger piece of legislation, which the House looks like they're having a very difficult time dealing with. So I think the House is going to try again. It sounds like the Speaker has settled on four separate bills. They may have a shifting coalition of people voting for each one of those, but then they'll package those, presumably, and then send them to the Senate for action. I have to applaud the Speaker. I think he's done the best anybody could do under very difficult circumstances with a one-vote majority.
Speaker is sending something else to the Senate, I think, this week, and that is the articles of impeachment against Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas. What happens to that in a Democrat-run Senate?
Well, unfortunately, the Democrats don't follow the rules, and they don't follow the Constitution. For them, it's all about political power, and the Constitution and the rules of the Senate are very clear that when the House votes for articles of impeachment, they come to the Senate The senators are then sworn in as jurors, and then a trial ensues. But Senator Schumer has 51 votes, presumably to table the articles of impeachment and avoid a trial. In other words, they just want to sweep all of this under the rug. All of the casualties of the Biden border crisis, of which there are many hundreds of thousands, including 9 million roughly people who've been released into the interior of the country, 1.8 million gotaways, 108,000 Americans died of drug overdoses, 400,000 children simply lost and abandoned as unaccompanied minors placed with sponsors in the interior of the United States. And the Biden administration doesn't know where they are or what's happening to them. This is, I think, Alejandro Mayorkas may be the agent of Biden's border policy, but somebody needs to be held accountable. And he needs to be held accountable for repeatedly lying to the Senate and the American people under oath, claiming that the border is secure when obviously it's not.
The other thing filling newscast this week, Trump on trial every day in New York. What are your thoughts on that spectacle in the courtroom and how it affects his election chances?
Well, as you know, I'm a recovering judge, Mark, and but even from my my perspective, this looks political. And Alvin Bragg wants to get a scalp, get a trophy, and unfortunately, that seems to be more common than not these days. And you know, President Trump, I have to give him credit for being as resilient as he is. I mean, I think most ordinary mortals would look at all this and say, you know, I'm just going to go do something else, but he's hanging in there, and unfortunately this is undermining public confidence in some of our most important institutions like the FBI, the Department of Justice, and our system of justice generally. So I'm very concerned about that.
I will presume that you prefer his win over Biden, but are you on the I don't even know what this word means anymore. Have you technically endorsed him?
I have. After the New Hampshire primary, I endorsed him publicly. I sent out a tweet saying I enjoyed working with him for 4 years and look forward to doing that again. I thought that was among the most productive presidency we've had in recent time. And I've had a number of opportunities to talk to him on the phone and visit with him in person, and look forward to working with him again. We're already beginning to make some tentative plans for January, after he's sworn in. We need to hit the ground running, hopefully with the Senate majority and with the Republican majority in the House and President Trump in the White House.
In our last item, let's talk about the near future. You're seeking to be Mitch McConnell's successor as Republican leader. I'm going to go crazy and say that means you are running in 26. It may or may not be against Ken Paxton. Got to talk about the tweet where you said to him, hard to run from prison, Ken. Well, looks like he's not going to prison, so he'll be out. And what did you think of the settlement that resulted in him being sprung from the jail term that you envisioned for him?
Well, I am an institutionalist, Mark. I believe that judiciary is the right place to resolve those issues, and I congratulate the Attorney General on getting that resolved finally after 9 years. But I'm not going to second guess the judicial process that I spent 13 years of my life participating in. I have confidence that in the end, justice is done. And, you know, as far as 2026, that's my intention to run again and hopefully serve as the majority leader. I've been in the Senate for a long time now. I've seen the Senate work well, and I've seen the Senate broken, which it is right now. And I'd like to be able to get the Senate back to work again, hopefully with President Trump in the White House, and to do great things for the people of Texas and the American people.
Senator John Cornyn, always a pleasure, sir. Thank you very, very much for your time, and I know we'll be talking soon.
Thanks, Mark.
You bet. Senator John Cornyn. All righty. 866-660-5759. Some things to had to ask about the tweet, man. And this is it was so un-Cornyn like, hard to run from prison, Ken. That's like from the Trump school of social media barbs. We made a lot of news there in those 10 minutes. The last couple of times we had spoken to the senator prior to his announcement that he was seeking to be Mitch McConnell's successor as Senate majority leader, as Republican leader, hopefully majority leader. Please, oh, please, oh, please, oh, please let us be in the majority after the elections for 2024. He had been keeping the powder dry. He had said, you know, 2026, all I want to do is pay attention to right now and things going on right now. But now we absolutely do have Cornyn running for re-election in 26, to the delight of some and the consternation of others. Let's take a couple of seconds on this. And you know what? I'm going to ask Matt Mikowiak about this. He'll be with us at 8:35, fresh back from Israel. Talk about being right there where the headlines are being made. But Matt's daily benefit in that wonderful Must Read Texas subscription service that he has, mustreadtexas.com, check it out, is sort of Texas politics at every level. And people have been trying to take Cornyn out in a primary forever. And I've said that's going to be nigh on to impossible. I'm not saying it now. It'll depend. We're talking 2 years from now. The primary season of 2026 is just under, technically, 2 years from now. And Cornyn is a Trump endorser now. If Cornyn is the Senate Republican leader, if he is the Senate majority leader and partners with Trump on a number of conservative things, Trump's going to show him love. And so will a lot of people who have been, shall we say, Cornyn hesitant. Trump made Senator Cornyn better for the 4 years that he was president, and I have a feeling he will do it again. Now, better enough that he can repel a Ken Paxton primary challenge? Well, we'd have to see that that's actually going to happen. I mean, there may be all kinds of, I talked about all kinds of behind-the-scenes stuff that if Cornyn did not run in 2026, you could have a free-for-all primary containing Greg Abbott for Senate, containing Ken Paxton and even others. Abbott may be busy as Vice President of the United States, because the Abbott vice presidential buzz continues to get louder. Because has anybody made more news in a positive way? Governor Abbott, by going what I call full Don Huffines, has become a border hero. So there's just so many things that are delicious possibilities that lie ahead. I think, generally speaking, though, I mean, if the primary were today, an ascendant Ken Paxton would give Senator Cornyn, around whom there's a recent memory of some Second Amendment softness, et cetera, would give him an enormous run for the money. 2 years from now, I think Paxton will still be strong. He'll have two more years. Well, you know what, if we're going to throw all this against the wall, you know what Paxton may be busy doing? He may be Trump's attorney general of the entire United States. So I don't know what anybody's business card is going to look like. Well, Cornyn's going to be in the Senate. That's about the only thing we know. Everybody else, who knows? And the question will be, are they happy where they are? Or are they looking for a job change in the fascinating election year of 2026? 8:20, Mark Davis, 6:60 a.m. yet. The Black Crowes and Only a Fool. They'll be on the American Airlines Center stage a little later this year when Aerosmith rolls through town. And are we working on what might be their last tour? I don't know. I think we have the last Barry Manilow tour coming through Dickies Arena in Fort Worth later this year. So just all kinds of stuff going on. Let me take a quick dance through a couple of things that have been happening, and then we'll look for Matt Mikowiak, 8:35, on what it was like to escape Israel right after the drone strikes and some stuff going on in Texas politics. Mike and I were discussing what ought to be done about what if it were you? What if it wasn't just video from San Francisco, video from Chicago? You're trying to get to the airport, trying to get somewhere, and a bunch of pro-Hamas jackwagon protesters have traffic shut down for hours in both directions. Senator Tom Cotton.
I agree with you that you have to get to these criminals early. If something like this happened in Arkansas on a bridge there, let's just say I think there'd be a lot of very wet criminals that have been tossed overboard, not by law enforcement, but by the people whose road they're blocking. If they glued their hands to a car or the pavement, well, probably pretty painful to have their skin ripped off. But I think that's the way we'd handle it in Arkansas. And I would encourage most people anywhere that get stuck behind criminals like this who are trying to block traffic to take matters in their own hands. There's only usually a few of them, and there's a lot of people being inconvenienced. It's time to put an end to this nonsense.
Take matters into your own hands. All righty. Hey, here's somebody who took a matter into his own hands, Scotty Scheffler. I'm going to give you another reason to love the fact that Scotty Scheffler won the Masters. He was asked about the win and went to a topic that I'm always pleased to hear people go to. Scotty Scheffler on his win and what the definition of real victory is.
Sitting around with my buddies this morning, I was a bit overwhelmed because I told him, I was like, I wish that I didn't want to win as badly as I did, or as badly as I do. I think it would make the mornings easier, but I love winning. I hate losing. I really do. And when you're here in the biggest moments, when I'm sitting there with the lead on Sunday, I really, really want to win badly. And my buddies told me this morning, you know, my victory was secure on the cross. And that's a pretty special feeling to know that I'm secure for forever. And it doesn't matter, you know, whether or not I win this tournament or if I lose this tournament. You know, my identity is secure for forever.
My victory was secure on the cross. Thank you. Transplanted Texan, wasn't born here, got here quickly, Scotty Scheffler. All right. Trump, it's kind of funny. I know Matt Mikowiak's Texas guy, but he's just big political brain. And so we'll talk to him in a minute. And I would ask him about the Trump trial. Upon arrival for day two, he pulled up to the courthouse just before 8 o'clock our time, prepping for another grueling day of jury selection proceedings. And he complained once again about the gag order. I'll find the audio for this. But here was his Truth Social post. This conflicted Trump-hating judge won't let me respond to people who are on TV lying and spewing hate all day long. He is running roughshod over my, Mr. President, roughshod is one word. He's running roughshod over my, editing takes a backseat, over my lawyers and legal team. The New York system of justice, in quotes, is being decimated by critics from all over the world. I want to speak or at least be able to respond. Election interference, rigged unconstitutional trial, take off the gag order. Now, the gag order prevents Trump from speaking about witnesses, court officials, and their families. This has been, you know, oh, he's talking about the judge's family. Like, that's a bad thing to do. Obviously, if the judge has a 12-year-old daughter, I mean, this judge has an adult daughter who is a Trump-hating Democrat activist. Do you not get to maybe think that that might be an issue? So many issues. Let's put our brains together with Matt Mikowiak next. 8:30, Mark Davis, Nikki Whaley's in the newsroom.
I was a bit overwhelmed because I told him, I was like, I wish
I
didn't want to win as badly as I did.
Scotty Scheffler interfering with my bumper music. You win the Masters. Don't mess with the show. All righty. Let's regather our composure. Listen, if that rattles me, what would it be like to be in a city where there's where a war has broken out in the skies above your head? Before we get to anything politically related, anything in the Texas political realm or anything else, Matt Mikowiak is back. So, listen, I've told everybody the story, Matt. What were you doing in Israel in the first place at this particular interesting time?
Absolutely. It was a pre-planned, pre-organized, pre-scheduled educational trip with about 10 other Republicans from all over the country. And, you know, Mark, had I not gone through that on Saturday night when the rockets came in, I mean, it would have been an absolutely life-changing experience, you know, going from Jerusalem to Tel Aviv down to the south along the Gaza border, down up to the north along the Lebanese border, swimming in the sea or, you know, dipping my hands in the Sea of Galilee, swimming in the Dead Sea. The list goes on and on and on. It was an extraordinary, you know, once-in-a-lifetime learning experience that was deeply meaningful and inspiring. And of course, we had a very interesting way to end it.
You could say that again. And I've always said this is something everybody should do. Maybe not right now. Let's get the war over. Which war are we talking about? Going at this time, but before we even get to the drone attacks or the successful repulsion of those attacks, what was it like to be in Israel as your own country's leadership seems to want to restrain Israel from actually winning its war against Hamas?
Yeah, it's pretty enraging and depressing the way that our national leadership has weakened that partnership with Israel in recent weeks. My intention along this was to have that once in a lifetime experience, which I agree with you. I think everyone should go if they can go, and there are church groups that go. There's lots of groups out there that make these trips possible. The other thing that was important to me is, I was affected, like I think most Americans, by the atrocities of October 7th. And so the opportunity to be there, to bear witness, to see and learn about exactly what happened is difficult and emotional as that was, I thought was important as well. I mean, Israel lived through, the worst day for Jews in the history of the world since the Holocaust. And I think to have the opportunity to see that, as unpleasant as it is, but as important as it is, I think was a privilege as well. And I did see that. I went to the site of the Nova Music Festival. I went to a kibbutz, Kfar Aza, where dozens and dozens were killed brutally, and where dozens more were kidnapped. You cannot deny the truth anymore. And once you go to Israel, Mark, your ability to withstand and be patient when people spew propaganda at you about Israel not only goes to zero, it goes negative. Mm-hmm. I mean, I get enraged now when I see these kinds of things on college campuses, when I see the word genocide thrown around Israel, which does more to protect civilians than any country in the history of the world, including the United States. The list goes on and on. So I went there to bear witness. I just didn't expect I would be bearing witness to rockets and missiles and drones coming in Saturday night.
So what exactly, when were you scheduled to hit the airport to come home, and how did that get delayed, and what did you see?
Yeah, so I got there last Saturday morning, and we were scheduled to leave Sunday morning, 2 days ago. I believe it's 2 days ago. And so on Saturday night, we knew there was kind of some saber rattling. There had been reporting that Iran was planning to retaliate. It's impossible as civilians to know the timing and the locations, right? Those are very closely held. I'll tell you, the thing that concerned me, Mark, and I was in Jerusalem on Saturday night. The thing that concerned me is when the pool report came out that the president of the United States was leaving Rehoboth Beach to return to the White House to be in the Situation Room, which I think was around mid-afternoon or even early evening, perhaps, or mid-afternoon, I think it was. That's when I realized that the proverbial you-know-what was hitting the fan. And so I did become... I will say we thought Jerusalem was probably not going to be targeted. The third holiest site in the Islamic religion, the Al-Aqsa Mosque, is in Jerusalem, right? Really adjacent to the Western Wall, mm-hmm. And so we really thought there was low risk there. And overall, only one of the 300 missiles, drones, and rockets came to Jerusalem. But I was staying downtown, or not downtown, adjacent to the Old City, very close to the Al-Aqsa Mosque and the Western Wall, within probably half a mile of that area. And so, around, 10 or 11 p.m., there was a loud boom. And listen, when you're in a situation like that, you don't know what that boom is. I mean, I thought it was a rocket hitting something. And in the end, it was either Iron Dome or the coordinated air missile defense that intercepted it and disintegrated it. But as soon as that happened, there was an alarm. I went into the shelter at the, underground, our hotel. I was only there 20 or 30 minutes, and then the all clear was given. But again, when you're in that kind of situation, it's an out-of-body, surreal experience.
Yeah, of course, you're in a shelter. When the time comes, when you're visiting someplace and it's time to go to a shelter, it brings some realities of life directly right in front of your face. All right, let's boil this into the realities of the American political scene. If you are the Biden White House, there are Democrats who actually still at least pretend to some level of support of Israel. I think the older ones do. The young Democratic Party, I don't throw pro-Hamas around ill-advisedly, but some of them simply are. And I have no idea what's going to happen at their convention in Chicago, but if you got people blocking the Golden Gate Bridge and blocking Manhattan and blocking the roads to O'Hare Airport in Chicago, these folks are in full throat. They don't care what people think of them. There's a portion of the Democrat Party that Biden must play to that is vociferously anti-Israel. I almost feel sorry for him.
Yeah, I hear you. I agree with you. I think 68 has a chance to be the rowdiest and most unruly convention, this coming year's convention in Chicago has the chance to be the most unruly on either side since 1968 in Chicago, which also was in Chicago. So you're right about kind of there is a split in the Democratic Party. And I will say, I do think there are some Democrats in the House and Senate who are pro-Israel. Are they as pro-Israel as our Republican members? No. And of course, we had this absurd, a group of 8 or 10 of them that voted against Iron Dome when that was approved initially, including AOC, who was crying on the House floor when that occurred. I agree with you. I probably wasn't throwing the term promos around, 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago. Having now been there, anyone that votes against Iron Dome is fundamentally pro-Hamas, because that means you do not want Israel to protect its 7 million citizens, 5.5 million of whom are Jewish, and who going into a shelter, Mark, is not an unusual experience. In fact, every building in Israel, 99% of buildings have a shelter, whether they're a commercial building or a residential building. Mm-hmm. You're supposed to be within a safe space, a safe room, 2 to 3 minutes, no matter where you are in Israel at all times. So, that gives you an idea of what it must be like to live there. Saturday night was not unusual for Israel. It was a little bit unprecedented because Iran attacked them directly and the sheer scope of it. But overall, that experience of going into a shelter and being uncertain is not rare. In fact, there were rockets going into Israel this morning. I tweeted about it. I have an app now where I get notifications. That was probably in the north, probably from Hezbollah. Hezbollah and Israel are going back and forth right now. So that's probably what that was. But this is a reality for Israelis in the region, and it is a reminder of how important that defensive capability, that partnership with the United States is, and how critical it is going forward.
One of our favorite strategists and analysts, strategery, Matt Makoviak is here. So Trump in court all week, every day. It's crazy. He's railing against it in the courtroom, but has a gag order on some things. I mean, how long can the narrative go that the persecution in the courts actually helps him? I mean, all the way till he wins 40 states? I mean, or at some point, does the pendulum swing?
Yeah, I'm amazed at the lack of discipline on the Democratic side, because, this is the fifth strongest legal case of the five. And that's not a partisan statement. Even people like Lawrence Tribe, the Harvard law professor, uber leftist, has criticized this case from the beginning. And so it is a very weak case. The question is, would Donald Trump have paid a settlement in this circumstance were he not running for president? And the answer is yes. And the reason we know the answer is yes is he likes to protect his family and his reputation. And number two, he's done probably things like this before. So the concept that he was trying to hide a quote-unquote campaign expenditure is absurd. And, of course, to make it a felony and to do it the way they're doing it and to treat him the way they are with the dishonesty and the unfairness is outrageous. Now, question. There is a chance. Look, I think there's a decent chance he's going to be convicted here. I think, in fact, it's probably a 75% chance. That will be a felony, and there will be a sentence. If they try to confine him at home or they try to put him in jail, you're right. We may have a 38 or 35 state landslide election. But I do think you're going to have a ruling before the end of the year. And I'm telling you, the appellate options at the appeals court and the Supreme Court in the New York State is not good. And so his options there are somewhat limited, unless there's some other option I'm not seeing.
What is, speaking of his options, what is his smartest, not the one name necessarily, I think we do this every time we're on, sort of the Trump VP Derby, and I think there should always be a large betting pile that's called somebody we're not even talking about.
Yeah,
but who sounds smart?
Yeah, look, he's got some time, right? Our convention is not until late July. Yeah. You have the Olympics in Paris in between, and then you have the Democratic convention at the end of August, so it's a little bit unusual this cycle. So he has a little bit of time. Look, I think fundraising is important, and there was a story in the New York Times yesterday about his desire to find someone who can help him raise money. He obviously is going to want loyalty. He's going to want a partner. He's also making a choice of someone who could very well be a successor, because the Constitution limits him to only serving one more term.
Yep.
So with all of that said, look, we've all heard the names that are mixing around. I know on the Republican side, we generally try not to care too much about identity politics, but if you wanted an African American, I think you couldn't do no better than Tim Scott or Ben Carson. If you wanted Hispanic, I think Marco Rubio would be outstanding. They have to deal with this issue of both of them being residents of Florida. If you wanted a female, my friend Sarah Huckabee Sanders of Arkansas just passed school choice, and is certainly has a great relationship. I'll tell you the other name, Mark, and that's Governor Greg Abbott. And I don't know whether he wants this or not, but if you want to make the border the central issue, which I think that and the economy have to be the central issue, what he's done has been so effective. The most effective tactic and strategy we've seen on that issue in 20 years, and he has a massive ability to raise money, as we've seen. So those are kind of the names that I'm thinking about and looking at. I'm sure there are others, and we'll see. It's going to be an interesting competition on that question alone over the next 2 months as people rise and fall and get vetted and do interviews and do other things.
If we go back to the black guy category, because there is one, Tim Scott, sure. Ben Carson, God love him so much, but we can't have two septuagenarians, I don't think. Byron Donalds, Congressman of Florida.
Yeah, you have the Florida residency issue as well. Let's not let that down
because somebody would have, Trump could just change his residency to New York. A lot of people say you can't have two guys from the same state. Yes, you can, but the electors could not vote for both the president and the vice president. So as Cheney in moving his to Wyoming, Trump would just have to move his to New York. Go ahead.
That's right. And look, I think I saw in the New York Times yesterday that Trump is on record saying he does not want to move out of Florida. And I'm sure there are a lot of reasons for that. Tax reasons, probably political reasons, maybe liberty reasons. Who knows? Exactly. So, it would be a lot. Think of it this way, Mark. Asking an elected official to change their residency out of the state they represent is a lot to
ask. And look who that takes out. Donalds, who is promising, takes out Rubio. And I still got a little hinky about Rubio. But Rubio lately has been pretty darn spot on, and he totally does help you fundraise. Takes out DeSantis. Hello, remember him. So, I don't know. I don't know. Last couple of minutes. Just had Brother Cornyn on, who now is all about Trump, even though he doesn't really like him that much, but he's a political expediency time as he seeks to be the Senate Republican leader, maybe the majority leader. Asked him about the Ken Paxton tweet, hard to run from prison, Ken. And Cornyn said, look, I'm an institutionalist. I respect whatever the judiciary cranks out. He congratulated Attorney General Paxton on having navigated that in that way. It look like we're looking at a Cornyn-Paxton Senate primary in 26?
Yeah, so there are several variables that are going to contribute to that scenario either happening or not, right? The first is John Cornyn the Republican leader in the Senate? And we'll know that in, I think, November after the election. Mm-hmm. That's a secret ballot. It'll be between him and John Thune. I think Cornyn has a better chance than most people do. I think it's at worst 50-50. We'll have to see. It's going to depend on who comes in. It's could Steve Daines, the NRSC chairman, may jump in if they have a really good number of freshmen come in. And Trump's endorsement in that race, is going to be interesting. Could it swing it? Could it swing it the other way? It'd be interesting to watch. So that's the first question. If he's not the Republican leader, I think he's going to seriously think about maybe not running for another term. Mm-hmm. But we'll see. That said, Paxton has a lot of options too, right? He doesn't have to just run for that. If Abbott were to leave to go federal, that's one thing. If the lieutenant governor were to leave and go federal, that's another. I think being a lieutenant governor is something that would appeal to Attorney General Paxton. So he's going to have different options. We'll have to see kind of where we are in the world at that point. That's probably a 6 or 8 or 10 months away type of, maybe more than that, 10 or 12 months away before those kinds of things start coming into view. But yes, a Cornyn-Paxton head-to-head primary, is, I think, at least at worst, a 1-in-3 scenario, Mark.
Yep, indeed. And listen, Paxton may be busy being Attorney General of the United States under President Trump 2.0. If we're talking about anything,
not out of the question.
Trump, they Absolutely. Love each other. They love each other. All right, man. Listen, I love our gigs. Welcome back. Glad you're safe. Congratulations. Appreciate you as always. I know we'll be talking soon.
Thank you, my friend. Be well.
Matt Mikowiak, always awesome. 8:51. Well, you know this well. This is a crazy record. You know what's wild about it? This is the hook. The saxophone is the hook. The hook is a part of a song that you remember, and it's usually a lyric. It's when somebody sings something. But in this particular case, before Jerry Rafferty opens his mouth, this is Baker Street. You remember this. And today we remember Jerry Rafferty, who would have been 77 today. Passed away back in 2011. Now, before you even got the Baker Street or Right Down the Line or the other solo records, he was in a little Scottish band, called Steeler's Wheel. Remember, Stuck in the Middle with You? That's Jerry Rafferty out front of Jerry Rafferty and Joe Egan. So you knew him before you knew him. All right, I know this. Let's hop out of this hour and into the next. Big grab bag of topics, stuff from you at 866-660-5759. Mark Davis, 660 AM. The Answer. Stick around.
3-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.